Welcome to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look, where we give you, the investor, an inside view on some of the best and brightest small cap companies operating in the public markets today.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily shared by people who are wrong.
Today I'm talking to Andrea Dobbs, who co-owns a Vancouver cannabis retail outlet at the Waterfront Building, 1540 West 2nd, with her husband, Jeremy Jacob. Andrea, my understanding is you've had this outlet for almost 5 years. Is that correct?
Well, we started planning it in 2014, but we opened in end of May, early June of 2014. So this is we've completed our fourth year. We're going into our fifth.
Can you tell me about the early days? How did you get the idea? What did you perceive the opportunity in?
I grew up in East Vancouver.
Yeah.
We've had the BC Compassion Club for over 20 years. There were dispensaries all over the city at one point. Right around 2014 is when I had my own experience in a cannabis retail space, and I had been left sort of wanting. When I went in, it was some young men who yeah. were at the shop. I went in with this particular issue, and that was perimenopausal symptoms.
Yeah.
And they were not very well equipped to manage those. And I don't blame them. They were 21 and very embarrassed to talk about lack of libido or sore breasts or insomnia. They just did not know how to handle it.
Yeah.
And as a result, I walked out of the space with a chocolate that was much too powerful for me and created a not very positive experience. With that information in hand, I thought, wow, you know, I haven't really seen a space that has been dedicated to or open to, people who aren't familiar with cannabis and who don't know what to ask. And there was the BC Compassion Club, but I hadn't really identified myself as someone who needed medical cannabis in that I didn't have a life-threatening ailment. I had this condition, that, you know, a series of symptoms that I wanted to address plant-based medicine. So it basically came from that experience and the fact that my husband and I had always been entrepreneurs, and his relationship with cannabis was much richer. It was about back pain, but it was also about stress relief, and it was also about celebration instead of alcohol. So together we kind of brought a philosophy that just seemed to catch on.
So your original catalyst, it wasn't about a gap in the market in terms of product, but more or less expertise.
Yeah, or lens, a focus, a space. My whole background is retail, so I literally love retail. It's where I play. I love display. I love merchandising. I love product sourcing. I love relationships with makers. I love stories.
So what did you do next?
Well, we wrote our business plan and we started knocking on doors to get access to retail spaces. And that proved to be almost as difficult as it is today. Landlords were quite concerned that you would be, you know, the kind of person who would take a midnight run. They were concerned that there would be police action. There were lots of fears around that. Eventually found a landlord who was both ethically connected to us and thought that we were doing something good, but who wasn't interested in making shovels of money on top of what a normal rent would be.
So back in 2014, you did have a license from the city.
No, never had a license. No, I applied for a license and they humored me in terms of not sending me to jail.
I see.
they just said, I cannot give you a license for that. But if you can move through the steps as you may and see what you can achieve.
Tell me about your first month in business. Who were your customers? How did you find them? And what was your competition?
Well, there at the time, I think there was like 114 shops in Vancouver proper.
Wow. Okay.
It was a very, very congested space.
Were you able to target customers looking for something similar that you were?
Well, two things were how we were able to establish ourselves. One was that we put ourselves right in the middle of the political activism in terms of working with government and engaging with government. So having that dialogue and putting our face out publicly really did help us, because I don't know if it's the same all over the place, but it's often hard to find a face behind a business that is not regulated. And so that helped, I think, to establish trust, because we were willing to be completely transparent. And then the second thing I think that just was, you know, a stroke of luck is that I got a feature on the cover of the local newspaper, the Georgia Strait.
Yeah.
And I was able to speak about why I was in the space, and that for me, it was about supporting women of my generation to come back to and explore cannabis from a different angle. And that was, the timing was perfect. There's women who are in a menopausal space are very isolated, and it's not something that's comfortable for people to talk about, generally speaking. So it just sort of seemed like a perfect sandwich. You know what I mean? Cannabis is awkward to talk about. Women's sexual health is awkward to talk about. Let's put it together and let's just start talking about it.
You know? I love it.
Has the demographic of your customer base changed in the last 5 years?
Definitely. So when we started off with that one lens around, you know, women and cannabis, that it also had to come down to like people's first exposure to cannabis. And in order to do that, we wanted them to have like the very best experience they could. So it was part of our mandate to source the highest quality, most organic, most, you know, responsible growers. And we quickly gained a reputation for having some of the highest quality cannabis in the city. It wasn't that we were trying to alienate people by being, quote, top shelf. It was just really about, let's make sure you're dealing with the best quality. And as a result, we learned so much. We met all kinds of connoisseurs and people who had, you know, lots of experience with cannabis. And I learned a lot from the people that actually came to visit us.
Did you buy directly from growers?
Yes. And very small scale growers. We purchased from people. Some people might have taken 10 pounds every 3 or 4 months that they produced, which considered, like, when you look at the production today, that's a very tiny operation. Yeah. And we found lots of women who were growers, and they have a very different philosophy. And we found lots of lovely men who did things like, you know, charge their water with like positive vibrations and created compost teas.
Were these mostly indoor grows or?
I would say they were like a cross section, greenhouses. Yeah. I had never visited a field of outdoor. That would be amazing. But I've seen greenhouses and I've seen indoor grows that are quite small and creative. And I have visited since licensed LPs, licensed producers. And that's also been really interesting. It's fascinating to see how people are trying to take, you know, a small scale production and scale it up while attempting to maintain the quality. And that's I can see a big challenge.
You're listening to the Equity.Guru podcast.
Just a quick note to tell you, sorry to interrupt your interview, but if you want more of these, you need to go to your podcast player, whatever that podcast player is, and go and subscribe to the Equity Guru podcast. You can do that through iTunes. You can do it through Google Play. You can do it through all the places. Equity Guru podcast. Do it now.
Welcome back.
How have your products changed?
Well, we went through a really big boom. I was excited to watch as cosmetics came in and body products, topicals and teas and pet products. And it was incredible. There was such a range. And for instance, if you were looking at tinctures, you'd have everything from a full broad spectrum CBD to like 8-to-1s to pure THC distillates. I mean, there was just everything that you can imagine. The vapor pens that were CO2 extracted with no carrier oils other than a terpene to make the oil more viscous. That was exciting to see. And so that is shocking for people now. BC, I think, was in particular quite an advanced marketplace. And, you know, it's still very robust, but the regulated is less robust. So we have, you know, dried flowers, capsules, and oil-based tinctures, and I feel particularly lucky because we had 4 years to establish relationships with people, and there are many of those people who want to stay with us as we move forward.
You've very recently become one of the very few totally government-sanctioned recreational cannabis storefronts.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Just
in August.
Yes, in August is when we got our official license.
How has that changed what products you are allowed to sell?
It completely. It's completely different. Because, yes, our flower is now purchased sight unseen. So we have to buy it ourselves as a customer to sample it. You're not allowed to see it. There's, reps aren't allowed to show you their product to help you taste them or smell them. They're actually purchased through the liquor distribution board.
Okay, whoa. So I'm sorry. Sorry, Andrea. Stop. Why? Yep. Why are you not allowed to see it, taste it?
That is just what the province has dictated. It's not the Canadian laws. It is the way that BC has selected to operate.
So what do you think their rationale is?
They don't understand. I think the people who've regulated cannabis don't understand that it is just like more like buying groceries than it is a computer. If I want a taste of wine, I'm saying, could I have a little sample? I wouldn't just to say, no, trust me, it's great.
So what could you sell in July? What did you sell in July that you no longer sell because you have a rec license?
I used to sell tea. Yeah. I used to sell cannabis that was served deli style. So I would have a large jar that you could look at, see, and then I would serve it in little glass jars that were fillable. I used to sell topical creams. I used to sell suppositories. I used to sell Phoenix Tears, which is a very concentrated oil. I used to sell vapor parts. The only thing I didn't sell was edibles, if you can imagine what is available in the marketplace. I didn't sell edibles, only because Vancouver asked that we don't.
We think January, it'll change in January.
They can submit their SKUs to Health Canada October 18th, I think it is.
Andrea, if we put your monthly revenue on a chart from 2014 forward, what would those charts look like?
It would have looked like a gradual climb until about 6 months when it started to peak. And then it was sort of moving forward quickly uphill. And then once we had to close, obviously it went stagnant.
Yeah.
And they used to operate on 100% markup. If I bought it for $10, I'd sell it for $20. And then I was able to cover overhead and pay living wages and and reinvest in the business. Right now, because in BC, the government distribution center is also a retailer and they compete directly with private retail. They mark their product up somewhere between 17 and 23% from wholesale. That is not something I could do. So we have a government retailer who not only undercuts private retail by at least 50%, they also have online retail and we don't. But it's definitely tighter right now. I have to watch this very closely. Like I've said, it's only been since August. Revenues have dropped for sure. I have definitely seen a drop.
So basically the government has given you a license to sell cannabis, but now you have to compete with them and they've rigged the system so that's quite difficult.
It's an uncomfortable one. I don't quite understand it. The whole concept around child, keeping it out of the hands of youth. I think we should be very clear. We're talking about teenagers, not youth, because 10-year-olds are completely uninterested in cannabis and they're not going to pick up a flower and eat it. And if they did, it would just be uncomfortably crunchy in their mouth. That's not a fear. I think it's about teenagers. And if you want to keep cannabis out of the hands of teenagers, you have to speak to them honestly. You have to be honest about what they can expect and why you're concerned about it being in their body and how it might actually help. If there are teenagers with anxiety or who are self-medicating, let's create a proper medical stream for those who want to explore it medically and another stream that is recreational, and let that be, let the recreational fly.
They tell you,
you'll die. Don't do this.
It's not as frightening as tobacco, but neither should it be.
And I think we could evaluate. I mean, it made me think, like, as we have to look at consumption laws, I mean, that's a big challenge, too, because, yes, cannabis is legal, but you can't smoke it anywhere. You're not allowed to consume it unless it's in your house that you own, or if you're lucky enough to live in a strata that says cannabis is okay to consume. But many people can't, and they have to go outside and walk in the streets to smoke, which is kind of weird.
So did the city force you to shut down for a while?
They didn't force. I wouldn't say they used force, but they asked nicely. They said, at some point, you're going to have to wrap this up. And so we consciously chose ourselves. We chose a date to close and to wait for our license to come in.
Do you perceive the black market being a problem for you?
I don't. No. Personally, I mean, I never met the kind of people. I've heard that there are people who sold truckloads of cannabis across the border. Those are not people I know. I can't wrap my head around that. But the people that I saw and the people that I worked with, no, they are not threatening. They are by no means something that I want them to be included in the regulations. I want that product to be included. I want their livelihoods to be recognized. I want them to be, you know, when I think about Vancouver Island, say, there's so many people who are employed that unregulated cannabis market that could not dream of finding similar employment in the regulated marketplace. And in particular, I think about all the women who were trimmers, and those women, you know, had kids. Kids would go to school and then they could go trim for a few hours and get $20-25 an hour. That was a meaningful part-time job. Those jobs are gone.
Where do you see the Village Bloomery being 2 years from now?
I see myself probably getting close to, I'd say maybe the fifth store. I know my husband would probably dream to have eight next year, but that's not how I want to roll.
How many stores do you have now?
Just the one.
But you're eyeballing expanding.
Yeah, I feel really good about what we created, and I think that it's something that will be embraced wherever we take it. But I want to be very mindful about where we take it and really only invest in communities that we feel like we genuinely benefit.
Do you see yourself expanding sort of throughout BC into other communities?
No, I could consider outside of in throughout BC. I'm going to go where it makes sense first and then start exploring. And in BC, I also think it's kind of interesting that we've got a cap. You can't have more than eight shops. So I kind of like that. I think it's a nice little number to work with. And no matter who you are, once you've got eight, you've topped out and you'll have to move on.
Andrea, thank you so much for your time. I learned a lot.
All right. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
That concludes another episode of Equity Gurus, A Closer Look. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. For disclosure statements and more info, please visit www.equity.guru.